I'm kind of making the general info, so I'm going to start even though everyone isn't settled yet. Can you hear me? Is that better? I wasn't sure how close to hold this thing. Anyway, I have first a couple of general announcements. I wanted to let you know that there are...
site. It is www.radical.com, and that's where a lot of the current information compiled by John on the 9/11 events has been compiled and posted on this website. And John also has annotated some of the articles, offering a little comment as an introduction to some of the articles. So if you're interested where a lot of this source is from, a lot of these articles can be found there on the website. And also COPA, which is an organization John has functioned as the director of, and among other things, is COPA is the Coalition on Political Assassinations. They'll be having their regional meeting in Dallas this year on the Grassy Knoll from November 22nd to the 24th. And this event brings together researchers looking into the murders of JFK, RFK, and MLK, if that's enough acronyms for you. And for more info, there's a sign-up sheet in the back, and we'll follow up with some information to anyone who's interested. And now for the intro for John. It is with great pleasure this evening that I introduce my longtime friend and political ally, John Judge. He comes to us from Washington, D.C., where he appeared last week on a panel hosted by Representative Cynthia McKinney at the Congressional Black Caucus Annual Legislative Conference, working to introduce legislation for the full release of squelched files on the assassination of Martin Luther King and hidden COINTELPRO records. As founder of the Committee for Open Archives and later as director of the Coalition on Political Assassinations, he has helped to promote legislation that has resulted in the release of over 6 million pages of files on the assassination of JFK, the largest release of classified documents to date, and they say they have nothing to hide. John was born in D.C., part of the World War II baby boom, and raised in the shadow of the Pentagon, the CIA, and the NSA. His parents were career civilian employees of the Pentagon. His mom was the manpower analyst for the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who accurately predicted the national draft call figures 5 years in advance during the Vietnam War. Many of us grew up in the 50s and... Hello. Many of us grew up in the 50s and 60s having to hang out at our parents' workplace waiting to go home with mom or dad. But few of us met our moms at the Pentagon and spent our after-school hours browsing through the Pentagon library. His early childhood interest in UFOs led him to read about so-called UFOs, which were in fact experimental stealth flights. These kinds of early revelations set John upon the path of a life filled with research and writings about covert operations, hidden history and assassinations, and the ongoing militarization of our society. Current research includes the events of 9/11, the growing World War, and the rise of domestic fascism in response to terrorism. In order to facilitate research into current events, John has joined with other researchers via email to form the independent network of deep politics researchers called In Deeper. As a grassroots political organizer since the 60s, John's heart, and indeed his life, has been dedicated to the creation of a more perfect future. And to use some of his words, a future that would ensure a global justice that could lead us on the path to real global peace and lasting security. Please welcome John Judge.
Technology tonight. I wanted to thank Mae Brussel. Some of you know her work, who died in the 1980s. She was a mentor for me for many, many years, as well as a personal friend and fellow researcher for nearly 20 years. We shared our notes. And I can tell you right now, with the headlines that are in the news, I would be calling her with the most recent update, and Mae would say, after finishing laughing, "Oh, my aching ass." She was indefatigable. She clipped 15 daily newspapers, 150 periodicals a month. She read 300 to 500 books a year. She broke it down into a weekly radio show she called World Watchers, which she thought would catch on like Weight Watchers with other housewives who would form clipping clubs. And actually, the beginnings of the research in the John F. Kennedy assassination, you wouldn't know this from the books, started with a group of women like that, Maggie Fields, Lillian Castellano, Mae Brussel, Sylvia Moore in New York, and women really began the work that was then handed to Jim Garrison and many of the early male researchers in the case. I am a dim candle related to Mae Brussel in my view, but I do my best. I used to clip the Washington Post and the New York Times every day, but the content has gotten so minimalized that outside of the obituaries and the social page, there's almost no information left about the ruling class. Except the propaganda that they're spreading, so I've given up on that. But I also wanted to thank Penny Schoner, who's done great work in terms of getting these events organized and getting them out, and also Lori Bradford, who introduced me and has helped out with this effort, and others in the Bay Area and over in San Francisco helped to promote these talks. I was able to get on San Francisco Liberation Radio. I was also able to get on KPOO, and with a bit of struggle, I was able to get on Dennis Bernstein's show on KPFA after I was able to disassociate myself from Mike Rupert, which I do, but I mean, it was their problems with Mike Rupert and also an attack on me by Chip Berlay, who constantly attacks me, that made me persona non grata for a period on a station that actually runs tapes of my talks during their fundraising marathons. I have trouble getting on live, but this is only a part of the contradictions of being a so-called conspiracy theorist in the current atmosphere of the left and left structuralism, which doesn't want to hear from it. But I would rather not be up here. I gave a talk in 1996 in Los Angeles, and it was actually the last of my talks until just recently. I did get to talk in Seattle in February, and one of the people there, a young man, came down from the university audience and said, "Aren't you afraid to say these things in public?" And I said, "Only because I never get invited back." And so I haven't really had a forum until just recently, and without Penny's work, I wouldn't have one out here. But in 96, the talk was titled, "Are You Scared Yet?" And the subtitle was Terrorism, Phony Terrorism, Counterterrorism, and the Strategy of Tension. And what I talked about were government plans that have been going on for 20 years to replace the threat of communism with the alleged threat of terrorism and to create a rise in domestic terrorism that would lead to the end of civil liberties and a march toward martial law and also a march toward increased war. It's not something that I wish I had been predictive about, but the reality is that the underpinnings of all this exist back to then. And so I would rather not have seen, as many of us, I'm sure, the morning of September the 11th and what's ensued since in terms of the society that we're now being forced to live in. And I'm certainly reminded of George Orwell's three slogans on the building of the Ministry of Truth in the year 1984. He was really writing about 1948, and that was the original title of his book. But the slogans are, war is peace, ignorance is strength, and freedom is slavery. And if you don't hear those reverberating somewhere in the current period, I think you need to take your earplugs out. I wanted to open and end with two paragraphs from a very prescient essay written by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in an essay called The World House. I don't know if you're familiar with this essay, but it's part of his theme about the future and where we're going and whether we're going into chaos or community. So the first paragraph reads, "Some years ago, a famous novelist died. Among his papers was found a list of suggested plots for future stories, the most prominently underscored being this one. Quotes, a widely separated family inherits a house in which they have to live together. End quotes. This is the great new problem of mankind. We have inherited a large house, a great world house in which we have to live together. Black and white, Easterner and Westerner, Gentile and Jew, Catholic and Protestant, Muslim and Hindu, a family unduly separated in ideas, culture, and interest who, because we can never again live apart, must learn somehow to live with each other in peace. On September the 11th last year, the United States entered the world community. And we were no longer exempt from the plague of horrors that have abounded in modern history in countries all over the world, and which, unfortunately, these horrors are ones in which the United States has been directly or indirectly responsible during the last 50 years. But it's 50 years of both covert and overt wars and coup d'etats, assassinations, an international commerce in guns and drugs, military and other types of political intervention, corporatization, structural adjustment under the World Banks and the current corporate and neoliberal model, and a long history of ecocide, ethnocide, and genocide that began in earnest with the Vietnam War. But was really a legacy of the end of World War II and the developments there under the rise of fascism. Does that mean, because the United States was involved in those things, that innocent people should have died on September 11th? Well, of course not. That was a crime against humanity and a mass murder as well. But the problem is that for most Americans, we do not know what has been done in our name in the rest of the world. For many Americans, we don't understand, as was asked after September 11th, why do they hate us in other countries? The version of reality we are given is that we are a nation of generous people who provide foreign aid abroad and help countries to go toward democracy. And while in the hearts of many people in this country, that may be their intent and it may be what they'd like to do or feel that they're doing, the deeper reality is different, and people see a different face of America in most of the relations in the world. And even the foreign aid that we brag about being so large and sometimes complain about not being used here for certain communities is about 70 to 75% military assistance and weapons. And that's a large part of the size of what's considered charitable aid abroad. The problem is, I think, that these things have been done without our knowledge, and that's happened because our history, with the inception of the national security state in 1948, has become a commodity of that state. Our history has been stolen from us, especially in the current period. It's always probably been distorted, but it became actively impossible to access after the development of the classification systems. There's one archive in Washington, D.C., not far from my house in Suitland, Maryland, that is merely the military archive of the National Records Administration. And this military archive is the classified military documents since the end of World War II. And they exist in Suitland in underground buildings. Each of the buildings is an acre in size. There are 27-acre-sized buildings holding merely the classified documents since the end of World War II relating to military operations. Okay. So we literally have to dig our history up now from its being buried. And when a people don't own or control their history, when they can't have access to history, that's a mark of a conquered people. And without access to that history, we live in a world where, as Martin Schatz quite presciently says in an early letter he wrote to Vince Salandria, one of the JFK researchers, he quotes this in the opening of his book, "History Will Not Absolve Us," about the Kennedy assassination. And the paragraph says, "The political paralysis in America is that we are allowed to believe anything but to know nothing." And so we can believe it's aliens from the Pleiades or a hybrid reptile race or a trilateral commission or a Illuminati. It doesn't matter. We're not allowed to know. You know, and Dennis Bernstein yesterday on Flashpoint said to me, well, this is interesting speculation and my mind goes the same way, but do we have a document? Do we have a smoking gun? Do we have something to prove that they could have had foreknowledge about the case? And I said, well, no, I don't know. I mean, this is the dilemma, isn't it? That we probably won't get the real documents for 30 years, although I don't know if you saw the front page of the Chronicle today, but here's evidence of a Senate committee getting documents that date back to 95, 96, 98, 2000, and 2001, about information that the different intelligence agencies knew in advance that planes are going to be targeted at buildings in the United States, including the Twin Towers, from the Al-Qaeda and these groups. So, no, I don't have those documents, but the secret committees of Congress have seen them. But for me, the question is not whether we could have or did have foreknowledge, because I don't think that essentially leads us to where we have to go with this, and it may lead us in the wrong direction. For the Senate Intelligence Committee to say, we had this foreknowledge, but we didn't use it, it means that we had an intelligence failure on September 11th, and therefore, how do we fix it? Well, we need to increase the budget of the intelligence agencies. We need to strengthen the intelligence agencies' coordination with each other. We may need to put them all under one particular roof. I mean, there's many solutions to this kind of a problem, but it's not a solution that does any of us any good. But there will be smoking guns to come, but, you know, if your goal in Nazi Germany was to document the Holocaust before you could do something about it, I'd suggest you might have ended up dead. Okay? I mean, we can't fully document because we don't own this history, and our reality, therefore, is also a commodity of this secrecy and this security state. And Eisenhower, in his departing speech when he left office, in the original speech, and I've seen the copy of what he actually wrote, warned about the rise of a, quotes, military industrial intelligence complex. That third word was dropped out then in the final speech. But he could see what was coming, and we passed over then on September 11th, in many ways like November 22nd, 63, a paradigm shift with different sets of assumptions and different messages being given to us about the world we lived in and the kind of power that we had. Security is now posed as the source of liberty, which I would suggest is upside down. Liberty is the source of security. And it's being posed openly that way, and it was Ben Franklin that said that those who would trade their security for, or their liberty for security, deserve neither. And we have this situation where we're going into, again, a permanent war economy. We're increasing the DOD and the CIA and the DIA budgets. And most people have heard of the CIA, but they haven't heard of the DIA and the Defense Intelligence Agency. But do you know that the DIA has a budget 100 times the CIA and the FBI combined? Do you know that it has 10 times as many personnel as the CIA and the FBI combined? Do you know that the Office of Naval Intelligence under the DIA is the oldest and largest intelligence agency in the United States? Do you know that the most secret police force and the largest police force, government police force in the United States, is the Defense Industrial Security Command under the DIA? Have you ever heard of an organization with the initials NRO? Those initials themselves used to be secret. It's out now, the National Reconnaissance Office, they run the satellites. The NSA, National Security Agency, which tracks every electronic communication in the world, these are all under DIA. The CIA can come up with a plan for an assassination, a coup, or some sort of thing abroad, but they have to go to the Pentagon and liaison with the DIA to actually carry out the plan, because the CIA doesn't have any planes or weapons or troops or people to move around on its own. They can subcontract some people, but they really exist in relation to the military intelligence. And I can find 600 books about the CIA, but I challenge you to find more than 5 books about the ONI. I only know of 2 books about the NSA, and they're both written by the same spook, James Manford. Okay, and he tells us a little, he doesn't tell us all. So the real inception of the national security state, dating back to World War I, is a history of military intelligence spying. Army intelligence files spying on radicals led to the Palmer raids, and those files were given to J. Edgar Hoover, which became the basis later of COINTELPRO and the attacks on civil liberties here in the United States came out of Army intelligence. Army intelligence was spying on Dr. King's grandfather, and they were spying on Dr. King himself. Okay, but we rarely hear of military intelligence or the role that it plays or have a way to take much of a look at it. And certainly this budget of trillions and trillions of dollars since the end of World War II has created a machinery of death that makes the old Nazi Hohenzollern Wehrmacht look like a rubber band affair in terms of its genocidal capability. Most people have been taken down a path since those years of seeing fascism an enemy, and then communism replacing that, and now terrorism replacing communism. But isn't it the case that those enemies, in terms of their actual threats, diminish, while at the same time what we're supposed to be financing in terms of a response to them increases? So that we need a bigger budget to deal with 6 terrorist groups than we did with a whole continent. that had nuclear arms. And, of course, all of this is based on government lies and staged incidents that are used to create wars. There's nothing unusual about staging incidents to create wars. If you go back in the real history, the Maine, the Lusitania, Pearl Harbor, Tonkin Gulf, over time it came out that these incidents were either prompted or staged or known about in advance, let to happen or created to happen in order to get the propaganda necessary to bring the United States into war. Most of you ever heard of Operation Canned Meat? That was an operation in Nazi Germany in September of 1939. The Germans went to the Polish border and they shot and killed Polish border guards. They traded uniforms with the border guards, dragged them over the border, took pictures of dead German border guards shot by Poles, and started the Polish invasion. It was Aeschylus the Greek that said that truth is the first casualty of war. And another element of war and operations, covert operations especially, is false sponsorship. Going back at least to the Boston Tea Party, where people dressed as Indians in order to dump the tea into the sea. Okay, just dressed as Native Americans. And I came to understand through growing up that these lies were such that everything I was being told that the enemy was doing, we in fact were doing. And we weren't being told about that. I mean, we hear now every day almost from the pundits that Saddam Hussein gassed his own people. He gassed his own people. He gassed his own people. Well, we gassed a lot of our own people. We killed a lot of our own people. Okay? And other countries have too. He's not the first person in history who killed segments of populations. I mean, you know, if you understand who really lives in Israel and Palestine without a Palestinian state, the Israelis are killing their own people. Okay? I mean, there's nothing new about that. And in fact, if you go to Nuremberg and the record, you'll find that the Nazi defense at Nuremberg was, why are you taking us to court for mass sterilization? You started mass sterilization in the 1920s in order to get rid of the retarded and the feeble-minded. You began to do it. We copied you. Why are you taking us to court for rounding up people and putting them in concentration camps and killing them? You taught us that with how you treated Native Americans in your own country. Does that mean one genocide can be defended by another? No. But it should tell us something about the mentality of a country that says, you know, we can take you to trial. And in fact, the United States wouldn't even form or take part in the international Nuremberg tribunals without the Collins Amendment that said that the United States could veto any charge ever brought against it under such a tribunal. And that rule still applies right up now to the international courts. We never want any, and it's not because we're afraid that they'll charge our GIs with crimes. It was in the New York Times just 2 weeks ago that we're really worried about Kissinger. We're worried about the top-level people getting brought in for the war crimes that they've been part of. So it's this sort of hypocrisy that we pick people abroad, many of whom we've put in power, and then we turn and demonize them. We've always been at war with Eurasia. We've never been at war with East Asia, they say in 1984. And then a week later, we've always been at war with East Asia. Eurasia was always our ally. Winston can't figure out what year it is. His job is to take the documents and go back in time and make the documents match the current propaganda. He controls the past controls the future. Okay. And so, I mean, that's the theme of the book. And so he goes back and removes somebody's picture if it's not convenient to what they're saying in the present. He goes back and changes the archives. And I remember Al Navis, one of the researchers in Canada, at one point in an early radio interview when we were getting the JFK files loose, and he said, well, we think about 10% of the actual universe of files has been released to date. And the interviewer said, well, where are the rest of them? And he said, the ink's still drying. But that's his job. And then when he goes to lunch, Winston eats lunch with a guy whose job is to reduce the number of words in the dictionary. And that's because eventually you won't have a conception of revolt or dissent because there isn't a word for it, you see. So don't give you a word, then you can't think about it. And certainly for even our own troops, they are expendable. They are gassed in wars. They're poisoned with Agent Orange and the things that cause the Gulf War syndrome. They're expendable. They're guinea pigs. War is a tremendous laboratory. And I learned these things fairly early on, By the time I was 10 years old, I was in a classroom and I was asked, well, I was told for the first time about nuclear weapons. And I couldn't really grasp them, but I mean, I knew it was this big weapon, and when it exploded, it could make the windows cave in a building and the roof would fall, and it would do this tremendous level of destruction. I didn't know about radiation, but I knew it was this tremendously destructive thing. And then I used to sit, maybe you know, I mean, do this still, but in my desk at school was like a little chair, and it was attached on the side with a little desk front that came around like an L shape in front of me, and I write on it, and you put something under it. Okay, and that was my desk. And so we were told that we were going to have a bomb drill for a potential nuclear weapon, and I was supposed to get down and sit underneath this little overhanging desktop. Well, first of all, I had come to realize that these people, these adults who I thought were there to protect me in my little child life, you know, I couldn't understand how did they have such a horrible weapon that it was going to like blow the whole building up and make it collapse. And I mean, it was unthinkable to me they even had such a thing. But then when they asked me to get underneath the desk, I knew they were crazy. The desk wasn't going to protect me, and so I wouldn't get under the desk, and I had to go to the principal's office, and I think it would traumatize whole generations, those drills. There were other drills I heard about where they actually put name tags on the kids and told them if you died, you'd be able to, their fair parents could find them afterwards. I've heard of other ones where the drill was to go outside in the lockers, open the lockers, and stick your head in during the drill. I guess it's the ostrich drill. Is a bomb go off yet? Is it over? Okay. And these were the drills for this horrible weapon. And so years later, I heard about Dorothy Day and the Catholic Worker Movement and how she sat down in Central Park and wouldn't go down in the subway shelters. And she got arrested, and then it was 25 people and 50, and finally 5,000 people out in Central Park wouldn't go in the subway. And she said, I'm not going down in a hole. You take that bomb off my back. Okay. And then they stopped trying to have the drills there. So I understood that fairly early on. I remember knowing that they were frightening by listening to the McCarthy hearings, and I didn't really have a full understanding, but my parents were afraid of McCarthy, and I remember their relief when Stuart Symington and Joseph Welch and the others stood up to McCarthy and stopped him. So I knew the government was frightening, and then during the U-2 incident, where this spy plane was shot down over the Soviet Union, or blown up over the Soviet Union, I've come to, in my research, believe, but during that incident, I knew that the government would lie, because prior to that, it was only those rotten commies who would spy on anybody. But now suddenly we had a spy plane and we were spying on them and we had to admit it. And then by studying history, and I liked to read, and I used to go have my mother take me to the library at the Pentagon, and I read there, and I read all the time at school during field trips. I'd hide, the bus would leave, and I'd go to the library and read. And by reading history, I learned about genocide. And I learned about the Inquisition, and I learned about the crimes of history against humanity. And so I came to understand that they were genocidal, not only in Nazi Germany, but here. And I also knew by the time the Vietnam War started that they were really out of control. And I also knew on November 22nd, 1963, that they were taking control. I got the message. I could see the movie change. I was still only 15 years old. I didn't have a sophisticated political analysis, but I knew when Kennedy went and LBJ came in and the war started that they were taking control and that they were killing hope in the late 1960s by killing Martin Luther King and killing Robert Kennedy. And in 1968, I understood that I lived in a society like Winston lived in 1984. And I began to study the political assassinations. I went from Vietnam, backed into the JFK assassination, backed into the history of the intelligence agencies, which was also the history of the movement of Nazis at the end of World War II to the United States and around the world in technological and spying operations, really the movement of the whole Nazi agenda. Thomas Merton, very prescient in 1936, said, if America fights Hitler, it will become Hitler. Because he could understand that in a society that doesn't have much vision, you mirror your enemy. And they really went about, after I studied these things, I studied or backed out of the intelligence agencies into organized crime, into heroin and cocaine, which fund covert operations worldwide. and mind control and mass murder, and finally to understand that they have no limits to what they would do or will do if they're able, and to understand that we are in the same position as the expendable populations of Nazi Germany in the 1930s. We are in the position of the miners in the 1930s who were told if the mine begins to collapse, push the mule out first because it costs money to replace a mule. All right? And that we're not central to them because they don't need us, and they don't need the labor. And fascism is not some little guy with a mustache who hates Jews. Fascism is a final stage in the monopoly concentration of power and control and money within capitalism. It's a stage that has to do with a devaluation of the currency. It has to do with economic collapse. At the same time, it has a tremendous concentration of wealth in the hands of a few, and with a technological leap forward that makes labor expendable. And then, depending on the biases of that particular society, it's going to see those people as useless eaters, as people that are taking up space. And so we're very much at that point, although it's not the only way that we can relate to that. But we're living in a time where I believe the extension of the fascist agenda and the dreams of those fascists, Mussolini called fascism corporatism plus reaction. And fascism was a form of socialism where the corporations became the state. And so when you have these preconditions, along with commoditization of everything, everything is marketable. All human interactions, relations, intimacies are taken into and stolen from us and then sold back to us in their most distorted form. So sexual intimacy becomes pornography within that model. And everything is commoditized, so that's why before they take them to the gas chambers, they clip the hair of the Jews, or they take the gold out of their teeth, or they melt down their fat and make it usable, because everything is a commodity. And every commonwealth is then privatized. And that's the current agenda. And I have a good book, if you haven't seen it, called Silent Theft, about all the methods that have to do with privatization of what's left with the commonwealth. But the commonwealth, which used to be lands that people lived on and held as commons, began to erode as far back as the 13th century, when the lords were given the right by kings to rope off as much land as they could, send thugs out to protect, and then to charge rents and to deed the land to them. And there's an old English nursery rhyme that's quoted in the beginning of the book, and it says, they hang the man and flog the woman who steal the goose from off the common, but the other man they let go loose who steal the common from the goose. What I suggested to Mae Brussels before she died, because the content in the papers was getting so minimal, was that we go back to November 22, 1963, knowing the cast of characters as we did, and clip backwards. Because prior to the event, I figured they weren't covering their fanny quite so well, and we could find out more. So I used that same method with September 11th. And I began to clip backwards to the beginning of the year. And of course, the first indicator to me was even before that, in November of 2000, when we had this break in the script that showed us what elections are worth in the United States. And this, when I say the script, I mean two candidates of two parties are put up, no third party candidate is allowed, a phony debate on phony issues is put forward to make us think we've got a choice between the two. If that's too deadening, then we'll be told that there's a horse race and that they're nose to nose in order to make it a little more interesting, as we were this time. But I would suggest that the outcome is already known in advance, and that they have never used the vote, that they couldn't afford to allow an election of that important to come down to a vote. That if they'll spend $10 million making sure who's elected in Chile, what the hell do you think they spend here, where it counts? And so the script is, you run the election, but it's really an ascendancy of a segment of the class. It's not a popular will. They don't go and count the absentee ballots and make sure who votes and get votes from overseas. They have a poll. And why you would have a poll in a democracy prior to the outcome of an election, other than to influence the outcome of the election, I don't know. But the poll tells you who's going to win. And then you hear people say, well, I don't want to waste my vote on a loser. and they vote for the person they're told is going to win. So, I mean, it can be they get a landslide that way by sort of, you know, self-fulfilling prophecy, but they don't need the landslide because they've already decided the shift is there. And then they don't even finish the polling. They have the national media count the exit polls, and before people finish voting, they announce who the winner is going to be. And then the other guy gets up and concedes. And then you have the president, and that's an election. All my life, that's an election. And then that night, Gore didn't concede. And I thought, what the hell is going on? I mean, Gore is no less of a player than Bush in these scenarios. I mean, they both have big money behind them, sometimes the same money, because if you're smart enough and rich enough, you bet every horse in the race. All right? So why is he not conceding? And then I realized, because they want us to see. They want us to know. They want us to get the message. And it was just as blatant a message as November 22nd, 1963. I believe that 63's message is, yeah, we shot the son of a bitch. What do you want to do about it? We can kill the president. We sure as hell kill you. Sit down, shut up, and get out of the way. That's the subliminal message. And the subliminal message of this election is, we done had about enough of this here democracy shit. We done already told you who won the election. Now set your whiny Democrat ass down and shut up. Get out of the way is the message. You know, and I think they pulled up the petticoat and let us and let the rest of the world know. And that was reverberated for me right after September 11th when one of the pundits said, well, it wasn't even a pundit, it was a guy from the White House, said, this war will last into the second Bush administration. We didn't elect him the first time. I guess we don't have to bother for the second time. Okay, but it was an open electoral coup. And he was in trouble. There was a global economic slump going on. The surplus was eroding in terms of the tax stuff. We were going back into a deficit situation. And then there were reports, among others, as you follow the news coming into the year 2001, that the United States paid $43 million to the Taliban to get them to stop growing opium in the southern part. And they did, to a large extent, stop some of the opium growth that was replaced in the north. But the Northern Alliance and Afghanistan have been providing 80% of the world opium, and actually right now they're back to that, but they did have a payment. In June and July of last year, according to Times of India and the international press, Colin Powell visited Pakistan, India, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, the surrounding countries. This is June and July, and he told the heads of those countries and the people in the government that the United States was going to militarily intervene in mid-October to remove the Taliban. This is in June and July. This war in Afghanistan is not a response to 9/11. This is a war that, as all wars are, planned in advance. And it has to do with the fact that in 1999, a representative on foreign relations from the company called Unocal went to the Congress and told them that 80% of the world oil reserve would be in the Caspian Sea region 20 years from now, 80% of the remaining oil will be there, and that we had to get a pipeline down out of that region through Afghanistan into the sea, and that the Taliban had balked on taking the deal on that pipeline, and therefore the Taliban were in the way of our access to 80% of the world oil in the next few years, and they had to be removed. And that message was out. Now, it's interesting to me that Unocal said at that point they stopped their plans and they hired a different company. A different company came in and started to make an alternate route across northern Afghanistan through Pakistan down to the sea. That company is called Enron. So the Enron debacle may, in fact, just be an oil war that's going on between these corporate entities. And Unocal is now back in the seat because Mr. Karzai was a consultant to Unocal, the head of Afghanistan, and the current ambassador of the United States from Afghanistan was an employee of Unocal. And the remaining five moderate leaders in Northern Alliance moderates, these guys were named in the New York Times 5 years ago as the largest opium dealers. So the oil is almost back in place. The heroin is already back in place. Okay, and but what I'm telling you is that we were already going into Afghanistan with this plan before they hit any of these bumps. On August the 21st, there was a very revealing article on the front page of the Washington Post. It had to do with an argument that had broken out between White House officials like Rumsfeld and the neocons, who were quoting a guy from one of the right-wing think tanks who said that America is an empire, it ought to admit that it's an empire, and it ought to get about the business of being one. and that we ought to create a Pax Americana in the world. And the White House was supporting this, but there were people still remaining, their heads have rolled now, but there were people in the Joint Chiefs and in the military and the Pentagon who said, we've got enough to do. You know, that this wasn't necessary to do this, that, you know, projecting this kind of empire stuff was going to take too many resources. And there was a battle going on about this internally, and I believe also continues to this day within segments of the class. That's where you're seeing a split now in the class about how to go about the war in Iraq. And it's only when the class divides and fights each other that we get a little peek in the window. Many of these scandals that I followed in my lifetime, like Contragate and Watergate, I believe are just openings of that curtain because the class is fighting each other, spilling the beans on each other, and because of it, we get to see a little bit of the internal workings. And so it's interesting to watch, I mean, you know, a period where you see quotes that you could almost agree with from Henry Kissinger and Brent Scowcroft, and, you know, unless you were a little more sophisticated, you could just about agree with them. But the Joint Chiefs were having an argument with Rumsfeld in the White House at that time, and then by late August, Bush clearly was getting into more trouble. He was having, his polls had gone down for popularity. He was having trouble getting elements of his domestic agenda through Congress. He was getting a lot of opposition from Daschle and Leahy and Feingold and some of the leading Democrats. The economy clearly was starting to fall. The tax deficit was rising because of his policies, and people were asking a lot of questions. And in addition to that, there were revelations coming out about previous CIA and other American covert operations. Mass graves in Guatemala were discovered that related to the death squads there. Eight Cubans were arrested in Miami for supposedly spying in the United States, but what they were doing was spying on the anti-Castro Cuban community that had been attacking Castro, but they were brought up on espionage charges and phony terrorism charges. And then there was a guy by the name of Kozak who had been in the State Department and was the involved in the U.S. Ambassador role and in the State Department in Nicaragua, who had been an engineer of the Contra war there and part of the Contragate operation. And he, currently in the State Department, back then was over in Belarus or White Russia, conducting an operation of the same scale, they said in the papers, in order to influence a pending election in Belarus that might have taken out a pro-socialist government and put in a more reactionary government. And all that area, Belarus, I mean, that was where the major oil fields of the Soviet Union were located, and the old Nobel family oil fields. And there's tremendous riches in that sector of the world, which is why there's such a focus now on getting at them. And Brzezinski, if you go back and check his writings in the late 1980s, he says we've got to control, once the Soviet Union falls, we've got to control that area up there. All the resources, all that cheap, trained labor is up there. And to get at it, we need to put military bases in Uzbekistan. And we just tripled the amount of aid to Uzbekistan, of course, again, with mostly military aid, and we're creating bases there. And I don't know if you read here in the local papers in the Bay Guardian, the way we create a base now is we hire Halliburton to take the base in a box with civilian personnel and guns, and they dump the base down and build the infrastructure, and the civilians guard it, and then the military comes into it. So that's one of the ways. I mean, and Halliburton bought out Brown and Root, which made $4 billion off of the construction they did in the Vietnam War. It was George Brown that financed LBJ into office. And then in turn, when LBJ reversed JFK's policy of withdrawal from Vietnam and went into the war, his political financiers made tremendous profits. And Cynthia McKinney, much to her chagrin and the loss of her election with the money that came out to defeat her, mentioned that, you know, perhaps it was worth questioning whether Bush and the people around him, most of which relate to the oil industry and munitions industry, might be making some profit off of the wars that they were taking us into and the kind of policies that they were taking us into. But that's not a legitimate question, apparently, for anybody in Congress to ask at this point. But here's this guy that relates back to the Contragate operation, running an operation in Belarus in early September. September the 5th, it was announced that the CIA will get its own primetime TV show, like the old FBI show. And on September the 4th and 5th, Well, also right before that, the right on that same day, September the 5th, it was in the papers that the United States was staging the largest joint military operation in history off of Egypt. So they're having this operation and this exercise, which moves most of the American troops right to the region where they're going to want to be when they go in October. And they're sailing around, they're connected with Egypt. Then on the 4th and the 5th, there were articles in the London Sunday Times and the New York Times. And they had to do with two operations, one called Clear Vision and the other called Operation Jefferson. I don't know if you've heard of either of these. These were being conducted out at White Sands Proving Grounds and also with some military contractors. They were both CIA and DIA related operations. Clear Vision was to do two things. It was try to create a lab with things that you could order through the internet and samples that you could order through commercial forces or sources to create anthrax. In other words, to grow cultures of anthrax in a laboratory that you could get to see if the terrorists could do it. The other operation was to see if terrorists could create and smuggle an anthrax bomb into the United States. And so they actually created a bomb, although they said later it didn't have a detonator and it didn't have any anthrax, that they brought this bomb and smuggled it in as a test to see whether terrorists could do this. Now, these things coming out caused an international flap because technically they're not supposed to be testing weapons or even potential weapons relating to chemical biological warfare. It's against treaties that they've signed, and so these secret operations were exposed on September the 4th and the 5th. But the more important one, Operation Jefferson, came from Rumsfeld himself. When he came into office, he ordered the Defense Intelligence Agency and the Pentagon to create the next generation of anthrax, to create an anthrax that would be genetically modified, be more lethal, be more resistant to the antibiotics, and be more distributable through its weaponization. And this is a direct violation of those treaties, to create a new weapon and a new kind of anthrax that would be harder to stop. And yet, they went ahead with these plans, and on September the 6th, the Defense Intelligence Agency had a press conference in D.C. where they announced that they not only had created but were ready to test a new generation of anthrax. Okay, that's on September the 6th. And this was all in the public press. And it was causing some flap, but generally the press just go and stick the microphone up there and they don't ask questions. On September the 8th, Ike Shelton, who's in the Congress and on some of the oversight committees of the military, put out a statement saying that they should start now to move U.S. troops to be near the section around the Caspian Sea because that would be the next hot spot for U.S. foreign policy. And he didn't specifically mention Uzbekistan, but he mentioned that area there. And when we think about oil, I just give you one thing to think about. Them going after oil. A lot of the times it's not because the U.S. needs the oil. I mean, the U.S. does use a tremendously disproportionate amount of oil. We're about 4% of the world population using 65% of the oil and non-renewable resources. But our main concern is not that we get the oil, it's that Japan and Germany don't get the oil. Because part of the way that Japan and Germany were defeated in World War II was they have no internal oil source. And so you keep them from getting oil. And the way you do it is to make sure first that they don't get a pipeline anywhere to cheap oil or have access to cheap oil. And the second is that you get the pipeline, you put the oil in a tanker to sea. When the tanker goes out at sea, ports bid for it. The highest port gets it. That artificially increases the price of the oil and brings it into a situation where you've got artificially expensive oil that they can only get at a much higher price, while you taking it from the pipeline directly can get it more cheaply. And this is the basis of the formation of the Trilateral Commission, is Japan and Germany were pulled into this axis of cooperation with the U.S. basically because they had to cut a deal in order to have access to some kind of oil. The second thing to remember about oil, and most people don't know this, is that the trade magazines in the mid-1980s noticed that 65% of that massive amount of oil use that we already have, in other words, 65% of the 65%, and they projected that 80% of the oil use by the year 2000 would be, and already was, military. I mean, this effectively means that we're fighting wars to have enough oil to fight wars. All right? And Schwarzkopf bragged at the 10th anniversary of the Gulf War at the University of Texas that they had used 3 billion gallons of oil to fight the Gulf War. I mean, that's more oil than they could have gotten out of Kuwait. Okay. So, I mean, there are two things to put in perspective, and of course the third is that we don't need it. We don't have to be addicted to oil or these non-renewable resources in order to do what we need energy-wise. And then, again, just before September 11th, the San Francisco Chronicle reported afterwards, you might have noticed that your mayor in San Francisco, well, not yours out here, but the mayor in San Francisco, Willie Brown, was warned not to take any commercial flights on September 11th by his securities. It was reported later that George Shultz was warned against taking commercial flight. It was reported a month earlier that both Rumsfeld and Cheney had announced that they were not going to take any commercial flights. And I should say that the standing joke in D.C. is that if Cheney should have a heart attack, Bush could become president. I mean, I hope you're noticing that when we're on orange alert for a terrorist attack, Bush is left in the White House and Cheney is put down in the bunker. And maybe you heard when Cheney came out here to the Commerce Club a few weeks ago that he mentioned that the black box is with him. So the black box disappears on November 22nd. That's the nuclear command box. It's not supposed to be with the vice president. It's supposed to be with the president. But he said it's with him. And it disappeared on November 22nd. It disappeared similarly on March 31st, 1981, when I went into detail on the Reagan shooting and the ascendancy of Bush. Okay. And so the positioning of that box and that control is important. The communications with that box were cut off on November 22nd. I talked at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base with the Strategic Air Command bomber pilots who were in the air the hour of the Kennedy assassination. And neither the ones I talked to nor any of their fellow people, as they go up on 8-hour shifts with a bunch of other pilots, and they're responsible for emergency response anywhere in the United States, and they're up in the air for 8 hours, and they might get a message. So they have a decrypting book, and it tells them whether it's a legitimate message, whether it's coming from the black box or the White House or the Pentagon or one of the command and control centers down in the mountains, and then they get orders all the way up to failsafe and nuclear war, possibly. So these guys are up there, November 22nd, 63. They get chatter on the radio that the president's been shot. They think that maybe there'll be a message. This could be an emergency. The president's been shot, maybe even dead. And they don't have a code book aboard. Then when they get down off of the flight, they talk to the other pilots, and none of those pilots have a code book aboard. Well, now that's the defense of the United States compromised in that hour. And I will tell you, whatever research you've done on the Kennedy assassination, there is not an anti-Castro Cuban, a CIA schlepper, or a mafia goon that can touch those code books. The person who devised that system and would have known how to compromise it is General Curtis LeMay, no friend of the Kennedys, and president at the Kennedy autopsy, reportedly grinning and smoking a big cigar. General Curtis LeMay could have compromised it, but somebody did on that day, and there was a change in terms of how the operation was going to happen. So I think there's reasons for that. I've gone into them in early lectures, but I'm just giving you an example that it's significant that Cheney says he has the black box. On September the 11th, I was awakened about 8:45 after the first tower was hit by a fellow researcher who is also sits on the community board about matters relating to Dulles Airport. And he was already tremendously concerned. He knows about planes. He said there's no way that a commercial flight should have been anywhere near that building. I mean, this is not just a little bit off course. And when planes do go a little bit off course, they're moved out of that and taken back, or things come to intercept them under normal procedures. But he knew there was no way a plane should have been in that airspace. And so it was already, to him, more than suspicious that something was really wrong in the situation. And as we talked, by 9:03, the second plane hit. And then I remember him saying to me, the balloon is up. The balloon is up. Because he and I believe the rest of the country knew that by 9:05, accident theory and coincidence theory, as I like to call it, were out the window. And most of the rest of the country did. And despite this guy, did you know that CNN, for the first time in history, the press was allowed into the war room in the Pentagon 2 weeks ago? And this is like the inner sanctum. They never let anybody in there. So I knew it was PR. to take you in and say they're showing you the secret in order to tell you the lie. And they have the guy who's in charge of the war room on September the 11th. It's a black general named Winthrop Montague. Now, I can bet you my bottom dollar this is not this guy's regular job. He was put in there that day to take the chump, as far as I'm concerned. He's not the guy who's going to be in charge of defending the whole United States. And he's not a guy that anybody's heard of before. And he's in there, and he says, well, we didn't respond because the FAA was tracking seemingly unrelated hijackings. When you have one hijacking, do you wait till another goes up to see if it's related? They're hijackings. What does it matter whether they're seemingly unrelated or not? But without any hijackings forever, and with all the warnings that they had that hijackings might be used, one would think that four planes coming out of two airports turning around known to NORAD by 8:25 might have been related. Well, then again, maybe you're of the camp that, you know, like the Washington Post and the New York Times, when the acoustic evidence showed that there was probably a shot in front of John F. Kennedy as well as from behind, and that someone was shooting from either the grassy knoll or some location in front, the Post and the New York Times published editorial pieces saying, well, it could have just been another lone nut who showed up at the same time to shoot the president. And besides that, there was no evidence that they knew each other. Who knew each other? I mean, you haven't given us the name of this fellow. How do we know whether or not he knew whoever the other fellow was that did the shooting? Okay. But there was no evidence that they knew each other, so there's no conspiracy. There's not a scintilla of evidence. It's just two lone nuts, so it's two unrelated hijackings. And we don't respond until we're really sure. But you know, they do respond. And I know they respond because I live in Washington, D.C., and I grew up around Washington, D.C., and it is the most restricted airspace in the United States. They force commercial pilots to take what they consider a dangerous turn to land or take off from Washington, D.C., and they complain about it to this day to keep them from flying into that airspace. That airspace, P-56, is composed of an inner circle and an outer circle, as you might imagine, because you don't want to just restrict the plane when it's already in on top of you. You want to get it while it's coming toward you. So there's an outer layer in Maryland and Virginia that you don't get into either, you know, at least without permission. So if something's off course or it's coming in, and I've seen them, small commercial private planes or commercial aircraft off course near D.C., things go up. On a normal day, I'm not talking about 9/11, things go up and they wag them and they push them back out of that airspace. And they don't let them into that zone if they're not authorized to be there. And that not just in Washington, D.C., but all over the country, there are standard procedures. The FAA and the NORAD and the Pentagon have procedures for any plane that veers off course for several miles, that turns off its transponder, that fails to communicate with tower, or that does combinations of those three. Why? Because the pilot could be dead. You know, there could be some confusion. You're endangering other plane routes. There's numerous reasons why you would go up and intercept. And then there are procedures to intercept, wag the wings, push the plane back into the course, restore communications. And this is all normal procedure. Okay? You don't have to wait for Winthrop Montague to decide whether they're related or not. Okay, I mean, you're on the ground and you get these orders and they come through FAA and NORAD's told. So by 8:25, NORAD knows four planes have been hijacked, almost unprecedented. There was one other incident about 20 years ago where four planes were hijacked on the same day, but almost unprecedented. And even if you don't have advance warnings, you know, it seems to me that even then something should have gone up to meet them. Not only that, but the plane that turned around in Ohio and the plane that turned around in Pennsylvania after the towers were hit, after 9:05, were said by the local news, Channel 8, to be headed toward Washington, D.C. Especially Flight 77 was specifically said to be coming to D.C. Now that's on my local news. If I knew it was coming to D.C., didn't they know it was coming to D.C.? I mean, I'm the last guy they'll tell. All right, so everybody knew that it was coming to D.C., and everybody knew it wasn't off course or an accident, that it was an attack plane. And they knew it from 9:05, they have the buildings, and shortly after that, this plane turns around, and they have 35 to 40 minutes to respond to do something about a plane. They don't have to wait till it gets to P-56. You can go get it in Ohio, can't they? And they have planes that fly 1,600, 1,800 miles an hour that are ready to scramble at airports. But we just sat in Washington, D.C., and we watched it come. We not only knew it was coming, they started to evacuate the buildings. They called an evacuation of the White House. They called an evacuation of the personnel at the at the Capitol, and they've called an evacuation of the Pentagon. Okay, so they're watching it come, and, you know, I know they said afterwards that it was a total surprise and that they didn't have any mechanism to defend themselves from such a thing. They don't have any mechanism? Where did they do with your $13 trillion? I mean, isn't there a subliminal message somewhere in this great protection racket we've been paying for since the end of World War II that they can't even defend their own building? So how are they going to defend you? I mean, isn't somebody getting some kind of a point that something's awry here? You know, and of course, they do have mechanisms. How do I know? I sat on one. When I was 10 years old, I was out eating lunch with my parents in the central courtyard of the Pentagon, and I sat on a metal box, and my dad said, "Get the hell off of that." I said, "What is it, Dad?" He said, "It's a surface-to-air missile port." You know, not a good thing to sit on. This is the 1950s. I'm not talking about, you know, last year. This is the 1950s. They had a mechanism that they could shoot a missile up from the center of the Pentagon to defend itself. We have military bases around D.C. Did you know that? We have a base called Andrews. We have an Anacostia Naval Air Station. They have the National Guard. They have Air Force planes, F-16 and F-18 fighters. A lot of times they're on scramble ready alert. Even if they aren't on scramble ready alert, you can get them up. Scramble ready, you can get them up in 3 to 6 minutes. Otherwise, you might be able to get them in 10 minutes at least. If you can't get a plane off the ground in 40 minutes, you don't have a defense anyway. All right, from anywhere. Do anything go up? Mm-mm. Nothing goes up. Nothing is used. There's even a surface-to-air missile port in front of the White House now because of that little Piper Cub that came in. And they said they didn't see that on the radar. They said it came in during between 3 and 4 in the morning and they have other duties then. They don't look at the radar screen. I said, it's a good thing there's no real terrorists. They're telling us come between 3 and 4 in the morning. You know, but this is how they try to cover up, letting this little plane stolen from an airport in Baltimore with no alert. There goes another one, Harry. Who you think's in it? By a guy on 100% psychiatric disability at the VA ward, whose son was quoted in the Baltimore Sun saying, "My dad owns keys to lots of planes." Now put those two sentences together and see what you get. I don't know who he was. They didn't know who he was that morning. The plane hit a tree, almost went into the bedroom of the Clintons, and they said, "But don't worry, the Clintons are safe. They're not here at the White House because it's being repaired, and they're over at the Blair House." And I said again, "It's a good thing there's no real terrorists." That where they are, we missed them. And then, just in case they didn't get the message, they said later in the day that the Clintons wouldn't change their plans. They were going out that night to the Ford Theater. It's just a coincidence. Then I tried to explain this thesis that nothing went up and why in this stand down that day to a guy at a party I met who was a correspondent at the Pentagon. And looking for a benign explanation, he said to me, "Yes, but didn't you read in the New York Times," and I've never been able to find the article, it must be sourced somewhere else. He said, "Didn't you read in the New York Times that half the planes in the United States were taken offline 3 days before the incident?" I said, "Are you making your argument or mine?" Half the planes in the United States were taken off on September the 9th or 8th? Why? Why do we suddenly take them off? Did they have no idea that planes could be used as attack weapons? Well, this paper today tells you, of course they knew. Not only did they know, they anticipated it. Not only did they know that planes could be used that way, they knew that they had been used by that particular group in the past that way, that they had foiled an attempt to take a plane into the Eiffel Tower, that they had actually gotten a plane into a building in Moscow during the operations around Chechnya. Okay, and the planes could be used as weapons. When they took Bush to the summit in Genoa, in the economic summit, they made special provisions that no planes could fly over the area where the summit were meeting, and they moved Bush to special locations so no plane could find him and fly into the building. They know that planes can be flown into buildings and used as weapons. 1997, I went to the Pentagon with a march called A Day Without the Pentagon. I organized the march along with some other people from War Resisters League. It was the first big march at the Pentagon in 20 years. I had to meet with 20 different security agencies because D.C. is such a hodgepodge of police agencies. And I had a special meeting with the director of security of the Pentagon, a black colonel who'd been there for 30 years. He took me into places my mother never took me. He took me into the offices of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in the hallway and past the place where they eat lunch, and he's pointing these things out to me. He walked me out onto the parade ground beyond it where we were going to meet and end up the march, and he said, you can't come beyond this line at the edge of the parade ground. And I said, but there's a Supreme Court decision in the 1970s that says we can come up here to the steps. He says, you can't come to the steps. We're on Delta alert. It was that. So that's our highest security alert. This is 1997. I said, why are you on Delta alert? He said, we get bomb threats every day from the Muslims, and we're on Delta alert. And then he pointed up to the top of the Pentagon, and he said, and we have radar up there to make sure a plane doesn't fly into the building. 97. He said, we've got cameras up there watching the skies, and we're going to be videotaping your demonstration. I said, good. Can we get a copy? He hadn't sent it yet. But I guess it's sources and methods being compromised, you know. How would they film you, and from what angle, and what did they see? So, you know, or maybe it's still over at the CIA for training purposes. I don't know. Did they go back to sleep? Did they turn the radar off? What happened on September 11th? You don't have to ask what did Bush know and when did he know it. I mean, for Christ's sake, isn't the question when was Bush told and how soon did he forget it? I mean, if June and July, they're telling Pakistan and India and Uzbekistan that they're going to war in Afghanistan, and then Tom Brokaw on NBC tells us that the war plan was on Bush's desk on September the 9th, that tells me that Bush is the last guy in the loop. Why tell him? He might mention it. Okay? I mean, he's the last guy they let know. You know, and stay up here, by the way, Mr. President. Cheney will take care of things. You know. There isn't any sense to it. Then I began to find out that not only did they not respond, they blocked response. Otis Air Force Base and Langley, they did scramble some planes. Out of Otis, Connecticut, they scrambled planes toward New York. We're not quite sure of the timing. The pilots say they were going full burner, but if you take the actual distance and the timing, it seems they were only going about 600 miles an hour in planes that do 15 to 1800 miles an hour. Okay, so maybe the pilots weren't lying, maybe they were told to go somewhere else, maybe they took off later than the PR story is trying to tell us, but they got to New York after the second tower was hit. I talked to somebody stationed at Otis who knew the pilots. He had spoken to the pilots. These two pilots saw that the second tower was hit. They knew about Flight 77 coming toward the Pentagon. They knew. They turned and targeted Flight 77 to interrupt it, and they were called back to base. Langley was named after we didn't have a mechanism, we didn't put any planes up. Then finally they said, oh, we did scramble some planes out of Langley. Among the Heroes is a new book about different people that day who were heroic, and they mention interviews of the pilots. You know what the pilots said from Langley? They were scrambled to go to New York. And they were asked on the way to New York to look out the window and see if the Pentagon had been hit. And they confirmed a plume of smoke 30 miles to the east. Look over there and see if we got them. What was going on that day? You don't have to figure out whether they had advanced knowledge. You've got them by the tail from 9:05 to 9:43. They did not respond to an attack on the Capitol, the Pentagon, although Washington was open. And we're sitting there, and I'm close enough across the river. When that plane hit, it shook my windows. It shook my house. Right? And I also thought later when I heard it was 77, one of my best friends and a fellow researcher who's an airline attendant had died that day, because that's her regular flight. As it turned out, she was taking care of her dad. And I know from her, just in case you heard this rumor, from a novel that was written in France, that no plane went into the White House, or that Flight 77 didn't go in, or into the Pentagon, I mean, and no plane went into the Pentagon. This flight never got to the Pentagon. It was some kind of a rocket. These rumors have been all over the internet. That plane went into the Pentagon. There are people locally who saw that plane go into the Pentagon. My friend was taken into the rubble and identified the pieces of the plane that she had worked on. My friend was shown pictures of the dead people on the plane. She identified the severed arm from a bracelet of her best friend at work. I mean, the plane went in. People say, well, if it went in, what happened to the wings? She said, do you know what's in the wings? The fuel. That's what happened to the wings. And that plane went into the Pentagon, and one of the planes went into the towers in a way that defies the ability of someone trained at a puddle jumper school on a simulator. In fact, the instructors at that school said if you tried doing those things on the plane on the simulator, it would have shut down. because the plane would have been out of control. That was dogfight maneuvers with a huge commercial jet. And you're going 550, 600 miles an hour, and you're banking to correct at the last minute to slam into this building. And even more amazing, the Pentagon situation, you're coming down from 7,000 feet at hundreds of miles an hour, making a 270-degree loop around the Pentagon, and then flying so low you're knocking off the lamppost in order to slam into the distant side of the building. Now, all five sides of the Pentagon are open. You don't have to go around to get to a side to hit. If you're on a military mission, aren't you going to go to the closest side? After all, you don't know that they won't use the surface-to-air missile. Why did they go all the way around to the only side of the Pentagon that is empty? 64 dead on the ground, 124 dead in the plane, 12 to 15 Pentagon employee dead. It had been under construction for 3 years. They went all the way around and hit the only side that didn't have anybody in it. Why did they go to the Twin Towers at 8:43 instead of 9:43? Why did that operation minimize the number of deaths? Hard to say when you have 2,000 dead, but 9:43 means tens of thousands dead. Most people aren't at work at 8:43. 1,500 people were taken out of the building from the 55th floor. This was a very sophisticated covert operation. Whoever flew those planes, and it's not remote control, knew what the hell they were doing in a plane. All right. And I would submit that we still don't know. We were never given the evidence. We were told the evidence was too secret. Only the British could see it. When the British saw it, they said it won't stand up in court, but it's good enough to go to war. We still haven't seen the evidence. We were given 18 names and identities, and five people came forward in Saudi Arabia and Egypt about a month later, and they said, that's my picture, that's my name, that's my ID, I'm alive, I was never in America or inside that plane. So we already got five that we don't know who they are. We got 18 that were supposed to be the hijackers, who are all Saudi Arabians, so we went and bombed Afghanistan. Okay. We're told that they're all part of the Al-Qaeda, and that they're run by the evil mastermind, Dr. Osama bin Laden, down in his cave that only James Bond, I guess, can get. Okay. What does it tell you that bin Laden did it, if in fact bin Laden did it? Bin Laden works for Saudi intelligence. Bin Laden works for Pakistani intelligence. Bin Laden works for U.S. intelligence. Bin Laden's in Chechnya. He's in Kosovo. He's in Paris. How many masters does he have? He's like Abu Nidal. You know, fight every side of the thing that's going on, and he's supposedly outside of our control. You know, the common thesis now is this is blowback, unintended consequences from an intelligence operation. But there were people tight with U.S. intelligence passing money to Muhammad Atta through Pakistani intelligence, through the same guy that funded bin Laden and the Mujahideen right up to the time of this operation. There's a guy named Muammar Ahmad. He's the head of Pakistani ISI intelligence. And he was responsible for passing $100,000 through another guy named Saeed Sheikh, who is now being convicted for murdering Daniel Pearl, the Wall Street Journal reporter. And interestingly enough, the Wall Street Journal was the only paper that reported this transfer of funds. $100,000 through Saeed Sheikh to Muhammad Atta in Sarasota. Muhammad Atta is supposed to be the mastermind of the 9/11 operation. In August of 2001, that's when this money goes. This is the guy that was in Pakistani intelligence when William Casey and the U.S., and Brzezinski, Carter, and these people start in with this operation to fund the demise of the Soviet Union by getting them into a quagmire like Vietnam, by undermining a secular, progressive government in Afghanistan where women were free, by funding reactionary mullahs and the fundamentalist arm of the Islamic people there in order to go in and stage a coup. A counter coup kicked them back out. The government coming back in asked for help from the Soviet Union, and the U.S. began to fund the response to that and drag the Soviet Union into a war that they knew would eventually destabilize it and cut it down further internally and help to collapse the Soviet Union. This was planned by Brzezinski, Carter, and operated by William Casey. William Casey is at the center of that operation of bringing thousands from around the world of these fundamentalist reactionary Muslims to fight against the Soviet Union, funding them through Pakistani intelligence to hide the U.S., then also funding them through opium and funding the Kosovo Liberation Army and other covert operations. William Casey is also behind the Contragate operation. Right, you remember Contragate and the shipment of these missiles and these other things? You know, and all these stories have not been totally unearthed. I spoke last night in the Women's Building, and I spoke there many years ago in the mid-'80s, And I talked about what I called surrogate. Because when the Tower Commission report came out about Contragate, everybody who testified said that March 15, 1985 was the day that a presidential finding was signed to ship TOW missiles to Israel and through Israel to Iran. That was part of the beginnings of this deal to get the hostages and this whole Contragate operation. And they said that was the date that it was signed. So I went back to see in my own records what was Reagan doing that day. Lo and behold, that day he was in prostate surgery for 8 hours. And the acting president was George Herbert Walker Bush. Bush signed the finding. Reagan couldn't remember it. North destroyed it because he's Bush's boy. And Bush was in ascendancy from March 31, 1981 on. Okay, so it's a Bush operation, it's a Casey operation. Both those operations also got funding, you may remember, through BCCI, the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, which was Saudi money financing both of these covert operations that Casey was involved in. Well, let me take you one step further. Mormor Ahmad goes back to Pakistan and in October his head rolls. Why? Because he's too close to bin Laden and because it's come out that he's sent this money at the last minute to Mormor Ahmad. And so his career is over, somebody else comes up, his whole operation isn't compromised, but he stinks too much. It's like when they found out that the bin Laden family was invested in the Carlyle Group that employs George Bush Sr., you know, and for public relations purposes they withdrew their funds. You see, so they have to clean it up a little, so this guy goes. But on September the 4th, Mr. Ahmad was in the United States. He was meeting with contacts at Langley, which means CIA. Afterwards, he was meeting with Richard Armitage. You ever hear that name? That's a Contragate name. I just told you about this guy from the Contragate operation who's doing Byelorussia in the current administration. Remember Poindexter, who was actually convicted? He's now in this administration in charge of data mining all computers in the United States and tapping all the phones for the part of the new Homeland Security. Do you remember the name Otto Reich or Mr. Negroponte? All of these contragators are back up there, and the head of Pakistani intelligence who passed the money to Atta is meeting with him afterwards. But even better, now we find out that on the morning of September the 11th, Mr. Muammar Ammar was having breakfast with two individuals from Congress. Their names are Porter Goss and Bob Graham. They are the heads of the Senate and House Intelligence Committees that are investigating 9-1-1. And he's sitting there having breakfast with them, talking about Afghani terrorism and the Al-Qaeda, supposedly, while the attack is happening. Is this blowback? Is this bin Laden out of control and no longer connected to the CIA? Or have we? And then I'll give you the final piece of information from a Sarasota paper. Atta is living in Sarasota when he gets the money. Do you know who he's living with? One of the Iran-Contra pilots. Now I got a recent clipping that just came out within the last week that tells us that two of the other hijackers were, lo and behold, living with an FBI informant in the same apartment. I guess he wasn't a very good informant. Or maybe he was like the informant in 1993 who told the FBI that they were going to bomb the Trade Center. And the FBI said, don't get in the way. Maybe we're like the FBI who wouldn't allow the investigation of bin Laden and the Al-Qaeda and led to the resignation of John O'Neill, who was the FBI counterterrorism expert, who then got a job guarding the Twin Towers and died in the Twin Towers that day, and who's mentioned in this book by the two French authors. Well, you know me. You can call everybody else, you know, a coincidence theorist, but I'm a conspiracy theorist. I don't know how many coincidences I have to come up with in order for it to be a conspiracy, but I'm working on whatever that limit is. I mean, I think I've gone beyond it, but if you don't think so, I'll give you three more. If I'm not getting you there, I'm working on it. Okay? But of course it was what Penn Jones used to call a happenstance. It's just a happenstance, he used to say. And so we've got a whole world of coincidences. But there's even another word in the press for it. The Washington Post said that the fact that John Hinckley's older brother, Scott Hinckley, was scheduled to have dinner on the night of March 31, 1981, when Reagan was shot, with Neil Bush, Bush's son, that the two of them were to have dinner, they said, isn't that ironic? If I told you that Robert Oswald, Lee's older brother, was scheduled to have dinner with one of LBJ's daughters on November 22, 1963, would you call that ironic? If you do, I'm an irony theorist. So I'm just giving you some pieces of irony now. I hope you can swallow them, because this is the time of the toad. Dalton Trumbo named a book that, and he based it on Emile Zola. Emile Zola tried to tell the truth about a political prisoner named Richard Dreyfuss, a Jewish man who was set up on a false charge by the right wing in his country and eventually got him exonerated, and he wrote a book, I Accuse. But Zola used to say that in that period when all the lies were going on, he had a method to deal with the day, and he would go down to the market and he would buy the newspaper for the day, he would buy a little cup of coffee, and he would take half a sou and buy a live toad. He would sit down with the coffee and try to get the toad down. If he could swallow the toad, he would read the news. I suggest it. Pomona, New Jersey, there's a base, 177th Air Wing, halfway between D.C. and New York, and get to either one pretty fast. We've talked to pilots there 2 weeks before they were told to go off of alert, stand down, and take the weapons off the planes. But that day, there were two guys on the runway who took off on regular military exercise that they do where they run up to New York, load weapons, and come back down to the base going over selected target sites and doing target practice simulations. So they went up in the air between the first and second tower hits. They were on the way to New York. And for the first time, they told us, in their military career, they were told to report back to base on an emergency. They thought, not being told what it was, that one of their family members had died. They never got to New York to intercept any plane. Okay. I'm not a congressional investigator. I just ask questions. I work with a small group of independent researchers. We look around and we see what's out there. And this is what's out there when you ask down at the level that they'll never get to. They'll ask the general what happened that day. They're not going to ask the pilot. But the pilot will tell you. And the guys that worked on the ground crew will tell you. And you can figure it out. I mean, it seems that it wasn't only the old order for UFOs, intercept but don't shoot. It was a new order, follow but don't intercept. Now, there is some indication that there were some planes following 93, the flight that went down in Pennsylvania. I don't believe the plane was shot down. There's been speculation about that. But from the actual descriptions I got, despite other indications later in the press, I think if they had shot it down, they would have been bragging about it. And I think the real secret is that they followed it and didn't intercept it and didn't shoot it down. Here's another clip. You'll like this one, I think. This is about the great mayor, Rudolph Giuliani. He's attending on Friday, September the 6th, this year, a Homeland Security event in Chicago. And people are invited to attend at this institute that deals with security and law enforcement. And along with Mr. Giuliani, they're going to have an appearance by John Fulton of the Central Intelligence Agency, who will discuss intelligence gathering and analysis for the future of Homeland Security. And it says here that John Fulton has extensive experience in the intelligence community. And on the morning of September the 11th, 2001, he and his team were running a pre-planned simulation to respond to the emergency that might be created and the issues that would be created if a plane were to strike a building. Then we have an AP report on the incident by John Lumpkin, dated Wednesday, August 21st. In what the government describes as a bizarre coincidence, one U.S. intelligence agency was planning an exercise September 11th in the morning when an errant aircraft would crash into one of its buildings, but the cause wasn't terrorism, it was a simulated accident. What building? Chantilly, Virginia-based National Reconnaissance Office. The NRO, the spy satellites, the DIA, is going to simulate an attack. Adding to the coincidence, 4 miles away, American Flight 77, the Boeing 767 hijacked and crashed into the Pentagon, took off from Dulles at 8:10 a.m. More coincidence. The NRO operates many of the nation's spy satellites, and it draws its personnel from the military and the CIA. Now, before they had the spy satellites in operation, you can see a lot from them. You can see a golf ball from them, read a license plate. Before they had them, they had reconnaissance planes the Black Hawk, and before that the U-2 that I mentioned earlier. I went to Dulles Airport 3 years ago, and there was an exhibit up about what you can see from a satellite and the history of aerial surveillance. And it was a phony exhibit because it showed these photographs supposedly of cities, and they're all hazy and you can't see any details. But they had a model of the U-2 to show what it looked like, and then they had a photograph in a glass case which they identified as a photograph the U-2 had taken over Cuba of some buildings and some trucks and some Quonset huts that they said from this photograph they could tell these were housing nuclear weapons that they had been given by the Soviet Union. And those photos were the evidentiary basis for the beginning of the Cuban Missile Crisis incident, the history of which has actually been rewritten by the files we got loose under the JFK Act. And if you want to see some of that history played out dramatically, there's a movie called 13 Days. And it's a prequel to Oliver Stone's JFK. It will tell you why they had to kill Kennedy. All right, but in those days when Kennedy blocked a nuclear war, effectively, from happening, and the Joint Chiefs and Curtis LeMay wanted to go ahead with them, they based their information on satellite photos that were analyzed by the NSA and the National Reconnaissance Organization out of the U-2. I'm looking at this photograph, and it's an actual glossy from the time, and typed at the bottom of the photograph are the words, courtesy of Jagger Childs Stovall. I'll tell you, 99.9% of the people don't know what that means. But Jagger Childs Stovall is a company in Dallas that subcontracted to analyze the photographs from the spy satellites, and the employee who was working there, most responsible for that analysis at that time, is someone named Lee Harvey Oswald. In 1959 at Jagger Childs Stovall, and this photograph that leads to the Cuban Missile Crisis is courtesy of them. Okay. But it's just a coincidence. Get close to time. Okay. I believe there was a military stand down on 9/11, and I think that that's their Achilles heel. I don't think they can argue that they didn't know anything was happening after the second tower, or that they didn't have a response. And it's the thing they're most vulnerable on, and they haven't given us a reasonable explanation so far, and I don't think they have one. And that's what I think we should go after. In addition, D.C. went into military and emergency response. There was a declaration of national emergency. There was a shifting of legal authorities that happens when that comes on, or declared war or national emergency. Almost 500 legal authorities change over. And running the country at that point are the DOD, FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, and the National Security Agency and Council. When the people at National Airport, that they like to call Reagan Airport, people at D.C. National Airport wanted to get back in business after a month and were losing money every day, they were told, that's not a local decision anymore, you have to take that up with the National Security Council. Continuity government means, which they put into effect that day, it means that a much smaller number of people actually make the government decisions. Then there was a headline in the Washington Post, shadow government operating in secret. Banner headline. I said, my God, I can get a job there finally. Shadow government operating in secret. And it said that Cheney and the middle management people of the government were all down in a bunker. Didn't disclose the location. It's Bluemont, Virginia. You know, it's down in this hole that my mother used to call the little Pentagon. And they had it was so old that they had closed it. They had to go in and upgrade the computers. And then he communicates back to Camp David on a big screen like Big Brother. This big Cheney comes into Bush, and Bush is up in the White House with the Congress. Now, which one do you think the shadow government is? All right, but a lot of military, and that day, it looked to me, and all the projections were that I had seen from the government, that they might go to martial law. They not only stopped the planes, they stopped the trains. They stopped the metro. They turned certain streets in D.C. into one way. They closed down a section of 395 in the interstate highway system, and interstate highways are one of the things that go under military control when you go into these emergency situations. Then I looked on the local TV and I saw park police with Uzi machine guns. These guys with little hats that take you around the monuments were out there with their Uzis. And then they said, it's time for the government employees to go home. Well, I know D.C. When you get the government employees out, they could care less about the people that live in D.C. Okay, most are black and Hispanic, poor people. So I figured they're going to clamp down. I don't know if the scenario is finished. I live near the Maryland border. I took my two hard disks and some books and some clothes, and I got in my car and went out into Maryland to at least see what the hell the next step was going to be. And I waited and snuck back in at 2:30 or 3 o'clock. It didn't seem to be a perimeter border, but I had no indication that they wouldn't do that. All the indications were that they were going in that direction. And I would suggest you, with Cheney in charge of the black box at this late point, that we are still in continuity of government since 9/11. D.C., if you come to it, you will see how militarized it remains and the presence of the military all over. They don't even talk to the cops. They just come out and close off sections of the streets whenever they want to. Okay. And the D.C. police are ignored. It's a colony anyway. And we've never had real local rule in D.C. Our license plates say taxation without representation. We did that so Bush had to put one on his car. Foreknowledge certainly was possible of these events. In a covert operation, you spend more time on the cover story and more personnel on the cover story than you do on setting up the actual incident. This is important because cover stories include false sponsorship. All right. The first week, they were blaming everything on the church committee. Senator Frank Church had these committees in the 70s that exposed the excesses of the FBI and the CIA. And according to them, the legal things that they were forced to do to not be illegal, to not hire assassins and take part in assassinations, you know, to clean up their act with COINTELPRO and all the dirty tricks, all of that had just shackled them so totally that they were incapable of responding or knowing that 9/11 was going to happen. You know, you believe that? Okay. You know, fund them some more. You know, see what else they don't know. All right? But this is what we're told. The church committee's to blame, and then we were told that we're redefining justice. The first comment was, I like those old posters from the West that said, wanted dead or alive. Those are bounty hunter posters. You aren't going to have a trial. You're allowed to shoot the guy and bring him dead over the horse back, and that's good enough. Then we had the quote, we'll bring them to justice, or we'll bring justice to them. What does that mean? That means revenge. Okay? Well, we don't need these international courts. We can have military tribunals run by the U.S. in secret. We don't have to present the evidence. That's all secret anyway. You might figure out how we're getting evidence against somebody. You know, and you don't have to be able to confront the people that are accusing you. You don't need an attorney, or if you have an attorney, we can tap them. They just start to redefine it, and one of the major things they're redefining is something called the Posse Comitatus Act. And this grows out of the British experience of the U.S. people with the British, who combined military and police forces in their occupation of their colony here. And that's why the Bill of Rights has things like, you know, you can't quarter our house and take our goods, you can't have unreasonable search and seizure. All of these rights that were put forward by Jefferson and Washington agreed to put into the Constitution came out of their experience of those rights being violated by a joint military police force of the British colonial rule. And that began to, it was a bright line in the Constitution that military and police are two different things. And that bright line began to erode at the end of the Civil War when occupying northern troops took over police functions in southern towns, were doing hangings and different things, and they passed an act in Congress in 1965, said, nope, we're going back to the Constitution, and there's a bright line, and Posse Comitatus says military is one thing, police are another. After Vietnam, one thing that they began to do was to militarize the police themselves, to make sure that a lot of veterans got jobs in the police, to begin to use military terms and war terms in police operations, to train police on military bases in war tactics and psychological operations, to create militarized police like SWAT, to create military operations against civilian criminal, alleged criminal activities like MOVE, like Wounded Knee, like Waco. These were done by joint military task forces that included the FBI and the police, as well as the DOD and the military. Okay? I mean, the entry device, isn't that a nice term, that they dropped on top of the house of MOVE in Philadelphia, the entry device, was C4 military explosive, which the police are not supposed to have. I found out that on a nearby base in New Jersey, they had practiced for 6 months in a helicopter figuring out how to drop C4 onto a simulated mock-up of the MOVE building. Okay? The other thing they did during the Bush and counter-drug administration, you know, they were about as counter-drug. I mean, if they countered any drugs, it was because they were wiping out one delivery route and putting in another. Okay, I mean, they increased the number of drugs massively, but under this cover that they were countering drugs, they not only created counterinsurgency forces in other countries, as they still have in Colombia, you know, under the excuse that they were fighting drugs, but they began to give military forces police functions in the drug war. And now, Senator Warner, since September 11th, has been calling for all the agencies to work together, have cooperation, and let's get rid of Posse Comitatus. So that's one thing that's happening, is that there's an erosion. And if you want a model for where we're going, go back and study Peru under Fujimori and Montesini. Montesini's from CIA, Fujimori comes in. They say there's a threat of terrorists called the Shining Path. They dismantle the constitution of the country. They take away the civil liberties. They establish secret military tribunals. And they do what the Bush administration is doing now. So you have an erosion of those two very basic concepts. But if you remember the story, the first link to the Al-Qaeda terrorists on 9/11 came from the FBI being led to a car in Logan Airport. They were led to a car because a guy said that he was taking a flight out of Logan that morning, and in the course of trying to find a parking space, he got in what he called a road rage argument from four Arab men in a car that wanted a parking space. And then later, when he saw that the planes had been hijacked, he called the FBI thinking he would lead them to the car where these Arab men had parked. Well, I mean, really, 5 years in the planning or something, big secret covert operation, and the day of the thing you're going to have a road rage argument in the parking lot of Logan Airport? I mean, you're already tagged as an Arab. You want to be tagged as an angry Arab? I mean, is it more likely that whoever this was that led them to the car is part of the game, that there was never any road rage argument? This reminds me of the bundle that was dropped outside of Kniep Amusement in Memphis, Tennessee, 5 minutes before Dr. Martin Luther King was shot, that had a rifle in it, which we now know was not the murder rifle, but which belonged to James Earl Ray. This is taking you by the nose to the phony evidence. And what's in the car? A copy of the Quran inside of a suitcase, and a flight manual for that type of plane written in Arabic. I said, if you went to the trouble to get it, why would you leave it in the car? It's not like the guy next to you is going to read Farsi and say, hey, isn't that a flight manual for this plane? You're going to cram the last minute. Okay, I got it all down. No need to take it with me. What the hell is that? This is false evidence. And then that car is, you know, relates to the IDs of four of these Al-Qaeda people. And, you know, they came down from Canada and they rented the car in Boston and blah, and now we've got our evidence and we know who did it. You know, within the day, we've got all the names. One thing that confused me was that for the first 3 days, there was not a mention of ethnicity. They said men with bombs, men with knives, men with box knives. They weren't saying Arab. I mean, I know America. If you've got ethnicity, it's mentioned. Arabs or black or, you know, Hispanic, it doesn't matter. If it's not white boys, when you say men with knives, you mean white men with knives. Okay? Because the others aren't men. Okay? And so, all these early cell phones, they didn't mention the ethnicity. And finally, in one story, they claimed that the wife of the guy that was like Let's Roll and the hero on Flight 93, she said that there were four Arab guys with red headbands on. The red headbands? I mean, what, they put them on the plane because they didn't know who each other were? They sure as hell didn't put them on before they got on the plane, did they? You know, I mean, what was that? So, I don't know still who did what or who they were. But then, everywhere these guys went, they made themselves obvious. They weren't hiding. We had four of them living in a house in Langley out near me, in the bedroom community out there of the CIA, in these little bungalows. They made so much trouble, two of the neighbors called the CIA and reported them. There were other ones the night before went into a titty strip bar and, you know, and put a Quran on the bar and said America's, and they're drinking, and they said America's going to be bloodied tomorrow. I mean, what is this? To me, it looks like false sponsorship. I'm going to see. I hit most of my points. Oh, I like that one. Yeah. Muhammad Atta's passport was found as they were looking through the rubble that day or the next day in New York. his passport from the plane, went through the fire, flew out of the building, and was found in the rubble.
Completely
unsent. Yeah, no, it wasn't burned up, and it was actually found in all that rubble. I mean, the only way you found it in that rubble is the guy in front of you dropped it. That's all. If it was found at all. But come on. I mean, that's like they said they found the axle within a half an hour of the truck in the 93 bombing. They said the axle must have gone down, so they climbed down and found this axle and says, oh, we got the axle, and that tells us it was rented in New Jersey. I never seen that written on an axle. You know? And then the guy that rented it went back three times because he said it was stolen and he was trying to get his deposit back. I mean, what is this? You're going to take a truck and blow up a building and you're going to go back and try and get a deposit? Nobody's going to figure it out. This is like Timothy McVeigh. You know what I call him? I call him the schmuck in the truck. Why? Because he stopped twice within 45 minutes of the bomb at the Murtaugh building on the street with another guy in the cab at a gas station at a corner. And what was he stopping for? Directions to the Murtaugh building. Hello? He's going to go to the trouble of load up a bomb in a truck and he doesn't know where he's going? You know where he's going to drop it off? Oh, I'm supposed to bomb. What is it? The Murtaugh building. Where's that? You guys know where the Murtaugh building is? I mean, if for no other reason, you don't want to be remembered, do you? Looking for the building. I mean, what is that? He's a guy that just is following orders. He gets there and his car is there and he picks up his car and leaves. The car is parked there. So it's like, take this truck and your car will be there. He doesn't notice that there's no license plates on the car. They pick him up in a state, first state trooper of the season picks him up because he has no license plate, pulls him over. A blue van pulls in front of him, according to the trooper's report. A blue van pulls in and they arrest him and the guy says, do you have any weapons? And McVeigh, who's just killed 180 people or more and bombed this whole building, says, yeah, here's my weapon. The little lamb. And then he's arrested, he's put in the back of the trooper's car, and then after he's secured, the trooper goes up front to the blue van and he says to the driver, I wasn't pulling you over, you're free to go. But he notes in the report that on the front seat of the blue van there are two license plates. Does that tell you anything? The schmuck in the truck. Okay. I mean, somebody's playing us for a sucker. And they're playing us for a sucker on 9/11 in the same way and in the same operations. But let me get to one more thing at least, which is anthrax. That's almost as good a story, if not better. Okay? We have anthrax attacks, just as everybody's starting to come down from 9/11, and we have anthrax attacks. Do the terrorists go after Reagan? Or I'm sorry, about after Bush? Do they go after Rumsfeld? Do they go after Cheney? Do they go after the Republican leadership in the Congress who's carrying on the war against Afghanistan? No. Where do they send them? The first place to get an anthrax envelope, as you may remember, is the tabloid headquarters in Florida. When I first read that, I thought, well, you know, the tabloids are a CIA propaganda tool anyway. I figured this is a false story, but the guy actually dies. He's a photo editor at this paper. Now it's said in the paper today that it was being spread by the copying machine. It was spreading the anthrax, and it got into the keyboard on his computer, and that's how it killed him. But it's just another coincidence. He's a photo editor at the tabloids who happened to be the photo editor that first put in pictures of Bush's daughters being arrested for drunk driving. It's just a coincidence. Okay, then where do they go? They go to Rather and Brokaw up at NBC and the national news networks. That's who they scare next. And, you know, I'm no friend of them. I know Rather was part of the lies in the Kennedy assassination, but relative to the current scope of discussion, these are liberals in the media. Okay, because the discussion has shifted so far to the right that it's a debate between an open fascist and a moderate conservative, which means that a liberal is what a commie was in the 50s, and it means I'm so far over there to the left, I'm a terrorist. All right, and the rest of us probably in the room. You know, you look like terrorists to me anyway. And anybody can be one. James Jarboe, in February when I was in Seattle, said that the largest and most dangerous terrorist organization in the United States is Earth First. Oh, I wish that it were so. You know, I wish that it were so. You know, but the largest and most dangerous terrorist organization in the United States are at Langley and at the Pentagon. and have been for many years.
Well, if you're a terrorist, okay. This is a terrorist organization.
Well, of course we're terrorists because we are outside the government and we have less power. We are only able to wage asymmetrical warfare, and we're fighting for justice. However we fight, we're terrorists even if we don't use weapons within that framework. So these are liberals. And then the main opponents of the Bush domestic agenda get envelopes, Daschle and Leahy, and a spillover to Feingold. Okay? And also the main opponents up till that day of the U.S. Patriot Act, who were questioning the U.S. Patriot Act up until they got the anthrax envelopes. And what's in the envelopes? An anthrax that's so sophisticated, they said it couldn't have been developed in the Soviet Union or the United States. I said, what's left? Outer space? And who else is left to develop something? But, you know, let's not admit it could come from here. It hasn't got any aluminum tracing because it's not from Iraq. We do the chemical tests on it. And then we do a DNA test on it. And lo and behold, it's AIM strain anthrax. That means it's U.S. anthrax. It means it comes from the most common place that anthrax comes from in the United States, University of Iowa at Ames, who maintained an archive of every known strain of anthrax. Anthrax is a natural disease. It's zoonotic. It passes from animals to humans. It's a farm disease. They've known about it since the 1920s. They took every strain and also tested those strains for antibiotics and other responses on those strains, and there's a whole archive kept of small samples so that they can be cultured and used. And there's a paper trail. So if you want this particular strain of anthrax from this particular batch, you send it out and there's a paper trail. Who experimented on it? Who ordered it? 10 days before the envelopes are sent, the FBI calls the University of Iowa at Ames and tells them to destroy the archive after 70 years, which means that we know it came from Ames, but we don't know from what batch, we can't tell from what batch, and without knowing from what batch, we can't tell where it went to, even though there was a paper trail before they destroyed it. The FBI called 10 days before and had the batch destroyed. That was in the New York Times. The bungling FBI. Was mailed. Yes. And when they looked at this anthrax, they said, this is like nothing we've ever seen. There's a trillion spores per gram. It had been 1 to 2 billion spores per gram in the previously weaponized anthrax. It's also so distributable, so fluffy, which means it's got no electromagnetic bonding on these individual spores, that anything will spread it. You know, the wind will spread it. It spreads like hell. And it's more lethal. And what does that match? Is that the next generation of anthrax that I told you about, that it was ready to test on September the 6th? I think it is. And then they not only went to Ames, it suddenly became clear that it had been weaponized through Fort Detrick. And the investigation went to the gate of Fort Detrick, and it stopped dead. For months, we didn't hear anything about the anthrax investigation. And now what do we hear? It's one lone nut. It's, again, a lone nut that did this. Only that's falling apart. The evidence they have on this guy is not holding. I asked the question in 1996, are you scared yet? Because in Europe, from the end of World War II forward, with US CIA and other intelligence-backed operations like Gladio and Propaganda Due, there were plans put in effect there and eventually brought here. But from the 40s on, there was this agent provocateur kind of situations where the intelligence agencies would set up, sometimes knowingly, sometimes unwittingly, terrorist operations, terrorist groups. If they didn't have enough weapons, they'd give them the weapons. They would make it possible for them to carry out terrorist acts so that they could blame it on a segment of the political movements in those countries and go after them. The one in Italy, particularly pernicious, that they talk about the strategy of tension, because this is state tension being created, used a right-wing group to bomb trains, leaving evidence to blame the left. It was used by the government to crush the left. Then they said, oh, we read the evidence wrong. It wasn't the left, it was the right. Then they went back and crushed the right. Okay. I mean, and they carried on these operations, and now we know from documents related to, in Bamford's new book, Body of Secrets, that Operation Northwoods and General Lemnitzer was head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff on November 22nd, 63. had plans to create terrorist incidents or simulated terrorist incidents in the United States that could be blamed on Castro and Cuba as an excuse to go to war with Cuba, including crashing commercial planes full of people. This is the 1960s that the Pentagon is thinking about, actively thinking about, and carrying through these things. And, of course, the cost of all this is civil liberties and the establishment of permanent war, a permanent war economy. We were told that we were going into a 10-year war the first week after September the 11th. That resonated to me because my mother, as Lori mentioned, projected the draft call figures 5 years in advance. She had to project them accurately enough within 100 people either way in the annual national call that went up to 50,000 people. She had tables. How many will retire? How many will reenlist? How many will enlist anew? How many will discharge under each category? And if there was going to be a war, she had attrition levels that she was given. How many will die? How many will be wounded? How many will discharge for medical conditions? How many do we have now? How many do we want down the pike? How many do we have to draft each year to get there? Then they would take those figures that my mother came up with, accurate enough within 100 people either way that far ahead, and they would multiply them by five. And they would give that to the draft boards as their quota. Why? Because 50 to 55% will flunk a physical, 10 to 15% will get a deferment or exemption from the draft, and 10 to 15% will no-show and resist, and we're back down to the 20% we want in the first place. This is planning, folks. So I asked my mother, she retired in 1973, she was not happy with the war in Vietnam. When she finally retired, she'd been a pacifist between the wars, but thought you had to fight Hitler, and then thought you had to fight communism, the same as Hitler. But Vietnam and the level of civilian deaths and the weapons freaked her out, as they should have. Civilian death in World War I is 4%. Non-combat related World War II deaths, 25%. Korea, 54%. Vietnam, 94%. That means in modern warfare, collateral damage is the combat troop. Get it straight when you're talking about going to war. It's not soldiers that are going to be dying in the largest amount, it's civilians. It's families and it's civilians because of the nature of the war and the nature of the weapons. So I asked her, when did they tell you that they would escalate the war in Vietnam? Because she had to be among the first to know. She said that in April of 1963, for the first time in her career, she was given orders to change her projections. They were from the White House. They were orders from John F. Kennedy. They were orders to change the projections in Southeast Asia, specifically in Vietnam, for a full withdrawal of American troops by the end of 1964. A full withdrawal by the end of 1964. I said, when did they turn around? When did they tell you they would escalate in Vietnam? She said, late November. I said, the last week in November, Kennedy's killed on the 22nd. She said, the Monday following the assassination. Kennedy barely in the grave. I said, was this just a few more advisors? She said, I couldn't believe the figures. I took them back to the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and I said, these can't be right. And I used to tease my mother afterwards that that was the first civilian protest to the war in Vietnam. November 25, 1963, they told my mother they were going into a 10-year war in Vietnam with 57,000 American dead. That's where they went. That's how long it took them. So when they told me September 11th, we're going into a 10-year war, I know that they plan wars that way. Then after that, we were told by Rumsfeld that it was a war that may not end in our lifetime. Just in the last week and a half, we've been told that it's a 60-year war. This is a world war. There's no other name for this. This is a war that almost, through its destabilization of situations in Afghanistan, led to a nuclear war in Pakistan and India. We're in a world that's too interconnected to go playing these games. Things fall apart. If we erode the international balance, everyone else will erode the international balance. This is a world war. We are in the same position as the German people in 1939 in September. Poland has been invaded. A world war has been declared. A genocidal Holocaust is looming, and it was up to the German people to stop Hitler. And it's up to the American people to stop this madness. There's no one There is no one else left in the world with the power that the American people have to bring this machinery to a halt. There's no other country that has the capability to stop this genocidal machine. What's been done that led to the events of 9/11, with or without U.S. complicity, has been done in our name for the last 50 years, and we're suffering the consequences. We're going to live the consequences of whatever's decided now. Should it be decided in secret behind a closed door by Mr. Rumsfeld and Cheney and Bush, or is it a decision that belongs to the American people? It is a decision that belongs to a real democracy. And it has to be. There was a paradigm shift that day. Another quote from Rumsfeld: "This war will secure American interests abroad for decades to come." Charles Krauthammer the other day, the reactionary neocon columnist in the Washington Post, pressed by others on an NBC talk show to give a valid reason to go to Iraq, finally blurted out, "There will be a tremendous financial windfall for the United States when we seize their oil." It's about resources. It's about what Buckminster called, Fuller called in the last book, GRUNCH, Gross Universal Cash Heist. It's about an alignment of a real axis of evil on September the 11th, and after that, an alignment of the United States, Europe, and the globalized corporations and their control through the World Bank and the IMF of the neoliberal model countries that they are corrupting and taking over the resources and the labor of, and the wannabes. Russia is the first country to call Bush with an offer to help. China jumped into the World Trade Organization September the 12th. Okay? That's what's aligned against what? The underdeveloped countries and the pockets of resistance that remain in the neoliberal countries and us. That's why we're terrorists, because we don't fit the model. I mean, we can be good Germans, perhaps, and a few of us can go along, but only a few of us, because there's not that much to go around when you concentrate wealth at this tremendous level. We're going into permanent war economy, deficit, economic slump, an end to social security and social services, increased secrecy, a curbing of civil rights. And I will say about rights, though, that they are conceptual, and they're on paper. Now, they like them to stay on paper. Their version of rights is, we should be so happy we have free speech, we sit down and shut up about it. In fact, their point of view is, if we exercise our rights, we sully them because they're so sacred. But I would contend that the only way you have rights is when you exercise them. I've been saying that practicing democracy between wars is like being a vegetarian between meals. This is when it counts, folks. This is when you have to have democracy, you have to have debate, you have to have an open access, but we don't. It's not the Pentagon that doesn't have any mechanism to defend itself, it's the American people that don't have any mechanism. We're the ones without a mechanism to instrument any popular will. We have a representative democracy that we all know doesn't represent us. We have elections to put them into power that are nothing more than what I call the evil of two lessers. And we know that. Most of us don't vote. I mean, who wants to throw their money away in a rigged poker game? They don't give us anything to vote for. Most people would rather vote on issues than on candidates, because the candidates can't represent us. You only need a representative when all you've got for travel and technology and communication is a horse. As soon as you have instant communication, you don't need a representative, because then information. Jefferson said, given a choice between a government without a newspaper and a newspaper without a government, he would always choose the latter. Why? Because he understood that information was more important to democracy than any mechanism that could be used to carry it out. They also realized, Jefferson and Washington, that parties, political parties, are inimical to democracy. Why? Because they put the decisions back in the hands of a few within that political party. I can't represent you, you can't represent me. Why would we try? We can represent all of us together by putting in mechanisms that make it possible for decide issues by referendum, but you have to open up the media. The media is a commonwealth as well that's been taken from the goose. Could you say the corporations own the media? They don't. They own the broadcasting equipment, but they don't own the licensing bands. Those are issued to them. That's a commonwealth. They don't own them like they own a mine. They're issued to them. They don't pay very much for them because they rip them off. But they don't own them in the sense that they've got a contract and a deed and a way to say, this is mine. They've only got a license. The conditions of that license are public. And the FCC is a public institution, and it is a commonwealth. And the American people realized that in the 1930s. They had a broad-based populist movement to stop the very first corporation from buying the very first radio band. That doesn't mean that they don't monopolize the electronic media. They do. And it doesn't mean they don't monopolize and own the print media. A.J. Liebling figured that out in the 1930s. He said, if you want freedom of the press, you have to own one. Okay? But if you want freedom of the airwaves, you don't have to own one. In that sense, you have to take back the right to license them, and the conditions of those licenses are a public matter. For instance, you could tax time back, couldn't you? Couldn't you say that for every 2 hours of commercial programming, we get an hour back for actual public use? That could be a conditioning of licensing. I'm just telling you, you have a commonwealth there that's been effectively privatized, but there's still a commonwealth aspect to it legally that you can use to fight for it, because without the flow of information, you can't make the democratic decision. We have to build a different kind of response, it seems to me, after September 11th to reach people. We not only have to overcome their fear and their rage, we have to build a movement that's actually inclusive of more people in this country, that's not based on dogmatic principles of unity. We had these principles of unity meetings at the beginning of the response in Washington, D.C., and I called them unprincipled disunity. There were a bunch of people fighting over what they thought they could agree on in terms of their political correctness, and they were a series of dogmas that said, we oppose, we condemn. And I said, at least take the we out and make it an active verb. If you say we, then you're setting up a church dogma. We believe this, you don't. There's a we and a they. At least make it an active verb, and then think about making it a positive value. I said, if all of us in this room could agree on something that unified us, it wouldn't help us end the war, because all of us probably already oppose the war. You know, my apologies to anybody who here doesn't, but, you know, we probably already do, so what does it matter what we can agree on? The only principle of unity of any use to us is a principle that unifies us with the people that aren't in the room. And what are those? Those have to be broader. Those have to speak to actual values like what real democracy is, about putting liberty as more precious than security, about the principle that violence only begets more violence and it's not the way to deal with terrorism, that a rule of law is more important than a rule of force or a rule of war, that there are costs to war that aren't going to be talked about, that justice is what leads to peace and the restoration of justice is how you end terrorism, that tolerance is more important than hate. And then beyond that, to a vision of a future that relates to the reality that we live in and that is hidden from us, because the reality is that we are in a surplus in human history. We have enough arable land and technology and resources and even water. We have enough technology for everybody to be clothed and housed and fed and transported, entertained and communicated with and interneted. Way more than enough. We can do this without hurting the planet. We can do this with renewable energy sources. We can do this in a way that doesn't destroy the rest of the ecology and the other species, and doesn't require us to totally change the presence of humans on the planet. We can do this in a way that takes care of people and restores justice. The people in Washington, D.C. in the mobilization for global justice often say another world is possible. What I say back to them is, envision it then, and let's show people what it would look like. Let's go out on the mall and build a future village. Let's show them that that future village can be run by alternate energy, that it can be governed by an alternate economy and an ethical credit system, that it can be an open media, that it can make decisions as a real democracy. Let's show people what the future would look like. Because that's the job that Jefferson and Washington did 250 years ago, but they were smart enough at least to know that the job they did wouldn't finish human history. Jefferson said he wouldn't expect his children to wear a threadbare coat just because it was his favorite coat and it didn't fit them. He said that probably you'd have to have a revolution every 20 years to keep power from accruing. Well, it's been a little longer than that, hasn't it? Okay? It's time for us and each generation to envision our liberation and to carry out that vision in a concrete way. And we've got a better view than Jefferson or Washington, who, for all the strengths that they brought to their own situation, were basically the petty bourgeoisie, basically the landowners and the slaveholders of their society, and lived in contradictions. You don't think we live in contradictions? If humanity survives 300 years from now, what do you think they'll say of us? What do you think less that they'll say of us if we don't act now? I believe that we are at a crossroad in human history. I agree with Leonard Cohen in the song The Future that love is the only engine of human survival. I think that to pick up a weapon in the 21st century means that you lack imagination. You can't beat them at that gun game, that violence game. It doesn't go anywhere. If you don't know how to use your head and your heart to win, you'll lose. This is what Dr. King was talking about. We need to start a discussion among all the people in America, not win a debate. And we need to decentralize power. We need to give people back their power, because not only are they separated from their history and don't know where they are, but they also are taught that they have no power. They're taught that it's impossible to do anything. Cynicism and naivete are the two sides of the same bad penny, in my view. One says you don't have to do anything, the other says you can't. But in fact, there's much that we can do. Rights are inalienable, they are conceptual, they are on paper, and even when they take them away on paper, they don't take them away up here. Even when they destroy a word in the dictionary, they can't really destroy the concept. And if we use our rights, they become our rights. So if they want to make it more secret, we should try to make it more open. If they say you don't have a right, we should use the right. Hats off to Medea Benjamin today. Right? Who went and stood up to them. And to all of us who will, on September the 29th, I'm involved in planning a demonstration that will leave DuPont Circle in the community in D.C., march up past key embassies on Embassy Row on Massachusetts Avenue, and end up at Cheney's house. We're not going to go to the White House. We're going to go to where the problem is. Of course, probably have to go all the way down to Virginia, but, you know, maybe he'll be back home by now if the orange alert has turned to, you know, peach or yellow or whatever other color it is. You know, I would say, be vigilant today and be wary. And I held a candlelight vigil and I was wary of the government, so I did my patriotic duty. I had a dream image November 11th that night. I grew up in the Pentagon. I heard it hit. It shook my window. It was a dream image of what Milton named the capital of hell, Pandemonium. I used to say in the 1980s when I lectured about draft counseling, I trained draft counselors when they thought the draft was coming back. To give them an overview, I talked about the militarization of the society. Dr. King said there's three routes to oppression: poverty, racism, militarism. The last is rarely addressed, but it's in full swing. All right. And I used to say that I don't know any reason to take a five-sided figure and point it to the south on one of its angles, except that in the arcana, it's the figure that you use as the pentangle to summon the devil. All right, and my apologies to the pagans who also tell me it's a protective symbol, but that's part of the arcana too, because it not only summons the devil, it contains the devil. And I used to say in the 1980s, the devil is among us, friends. But on September the 11th in my dream, the Pentagon glowed against a background of black. A plane smashed into the side of the pentangle and broke it open, and a red energy poured out. The devil's loose. The devil's loose and has to be contained. The devil has to be circled, put back in its pentangle, and then the pentangle and the energy that summoned it destroyed, and the technology to summon it destroyed. Human history has to be changed. Either we're going to go down the nightmare path of continued ecocide, genocide, ethnocide, the dead-end path of human history, or we're going to change human history and go into a future that all of us control. We own it. It's up to us. And I'll finish with the last paragraph from Dr. King, from the World House, to say what he said. Again, this is very prescient, many years ago. And I know about saying things too soon. In the mid-90s, I commented on the Murtaugh building in Steam Shovel Press, and Ken Thomas, the editor, sent me my quote, where I said, I knew that day that this was not foreign terrorists bombing the federal building in Oklahoma City because it has no political significance. I said, if this had been foreign terrorists, it would have been the Twin Towers in New York or a building in D.C. And he sent me the email and he said, prescient, and I wrote him back and I said, either you've got to give me priority or prediction or I'm a member of the Taliban. We are now faced, said Dr. King, with the fact that tomorrow is today. We are confronted with the fierce urgency of now. In this unfinished conundrum of life and history, there is such a thing as being too late. Procrastination is still the thief of time. Life often leaves us standing here, naked and dejected, with a lost opportunity. The tide in the affairs of men does not remain in the flood, it ebbs. We may cry out desperately for time to pause in her passage, but time is deaf to every plea and rushes on. Over the bleached bones and jumbled residues of numerous civilizations are written the pathetic words, too late. There is an invisible book of life that faithfully records our vigilance or our neglect. The moving finger writes, and having writ, moves on. We still have a choice today: nonviolent coexistence or violent co-annihilation. This may well be mankind's last chance to choose between chaos and community. It's up to us.
Now, thank you for coming.
I have a question. It strikes me odd, it might strike you odd as well. Why would the